Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
Welcome back to another edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Mr. Gabriel Montoya. Wow, do we have a lot of things here on Leaving the Ring to talk about. You know, we miss a week, and we get mobbed by everybody saying, what happened? You guys can't do this. So I apologize, but we're going to make it up. We're making it up by the day. I'm going to catch up with everything that happened this past weekend from the other weekend. From Rigondeaux to Nonito Donaire, all the way down to Saul Canelo Alvarez and Austin Trout. A little bit of controversy there between the fight fans and between media of how to score that fight. I'm pretty sure there was no trouble in scoring the Rigondeaux and Nonito Donaire fight. That was a clear shutout, what we witnessed on Saturday night. And I must say, I had my pick, man. I ended up putting out my pick and I got it right. You know, same thing with Saul Canelo. I got that pick right as well. Actually, let me take that back. Nonito Donaire, I thought that he was going to get knocked out. I thought for sure that as soon as Rigondeaux was able to really lock his punch. And if you remember back, I had said that Nonito to me was more of a machine gun. A guy that just lets bullets go and wherever they land and hit, that's what it's going to be. In those areas, it didn't really matter. He doesn't set punches up. He doesn't do that like the way he used to do when we all fell in love with Nonito Donaire, when he fought like Vic Darchinian. Okay, he was the underdog. He was a counter puncher. He was a patient. He was a patient warrior. And as soon as we saw the power, even after the Fernando Montiel, we saw that power. All the fans got crazy about it. Immediately he jumped up to being a pound for pound fighter and all the media blog guys and, you know, Ring and you name it, everybody's list. He was, you know, number two, number three, and a number four. And sometimes, in my opinion, sometimes that destroys a fighter. It starts to make them believe that they're not human anymore. That they can get themselves out of any situation because the fact is that they believe they're Superman now. So here's my thing. Could the Rigondeaux been able to do what he was able to do 2 weeks ago to Nonito Donaire if he would have faced the Nonito Donaire who faced Vic Darchinian? I still say yes, but I think it would have been a much closer fight. And I think you would have been able to catch Rigondeaux because Rigondeaux would have had to take a little bit more in the chance department. I thought it was a great fight. I know some fight fans were calling Rigabor. He's not a good fighter. Nobody's going to want to pay to watch him. Well, here, listen, that's why they have promoters. That's why they have managers. And let's be honest here. You know, I mean, so in other words, you want to see Nonito Donaire get in and fight guys that you already know he's going to beat? These are not competitive fights. At least we know. And here's the funny thing is that all the people that bagged on this fight, bagged on Rigondeaux, were saying he only has 11 fights, he's been hurt before, blah, 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 blah. Now, how about praising the guy and saying, hey, with 11 fights, he decided to fight your pound-for-pound fighter. Your fighter that's been awarded Fighter of the Year. And he took him to school. Took him to school. I think it's time the fight fans need to let up on this pound-for-pound crap and start just tuning in a little bit on the skill level and go from there. Now, let's go into Canelo Alvarez. Oh, no, go ahead, Gabriel. I didn't know you were on yet. Go for it.
I got you on video. There I am. It's kind of a new feature. I don't even know if you really want to look at me during the show. But I just figured, you know, the way the chaotic nature, we'd give it a try.
I don't think anybody wants to see me right now. You know, I didn't even comb my hair. I just jumped out of the shower, just got home from work, and I was rushing and stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, I kind of just did, basically the same thing. But I put clothes on. You know, I thought the fight, you know, speaking of clothes, was a bit of an undressing. A lot of things got exposed with Donaire. His relationship with Robert Garcia, while I respect that they believe that it works, and what Robert brings to the table, you know, Nonito's kind of assembled a whole team of people. He used to have Victor Conte, and that brought Remy Korchemny. They did the sprint training. Really, he was like a state-of-the-art athlete with Mike Basil and Brian Schwartz working with him as the strength coaches, also kind of, you know, day-to-day, and also the boxing coach day-to-day. And then Garcia would kind of fine-tune things over the phone, or he would come in a couple times, or some one camp, but I don't think he came in at all. Maybe he came in once for the Nishioka fight. He was certainly here for this one to watch the final sparring, the final week of sparring. But Nonito's kind of always played it by his rules. I mean, this camp, because his wife is pregnant, she's due in July, he's flying every weekend to Las Vegas. And that's just not going to get it, you know. That's tiring, that kind of travel, sitting in the airport, delayed flight. And they do happen, even on those little short jumps. I've been traveling a lot lately. And I just know it's draining. You can't do it every week. And then during the week to be training and fighting, it also messes with your hydration, all kinds of things, that kind of travel. And then you travel to New York to fight, one last big trip.
Let's note in there, too, talking to your trainer over the phone and not physically having them there to give you direction or to have a game plan. And here's the thing, too. Nonito later saying he didn't watch any tape on Rigondeaux. Listen, guys, if you're a professional, you need to act like a professional. You need to behave like a professional. When I hear a fighter say, well, I didn't watch any tape, you know, to me it was, I don't care enough for the sport anymore. And I've said this a long time ago. I think I said this about a year ago here on Leaving the Ring and to my co-host Gabriel here. I said I've never looked at Nonito anymore as a fighter. I look at him as a pure entertainer, a guy that likes the admiration that people are giving him. But is he really working for the admiration because he was giving fight fans the fights that he knew he could win? So there's a difference of a fighter and an entertainer, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, I think it's just like any fighter. I think our tendency is to blow a guy up. I mean, you and I have been pretty honest about his career. You know, it's like, look, these are showcase fights. I mean, I thought the Wilfredo Vasquez fight, people kind of lumped that one in. I don't look at that fight that way. I thought that was really a solid opponent, kind of something of a potential contemporary. And Nonito showed himself to be the better man. He was prepared in that fight. But gradually, I think, you know, for one, I think he thought because he was hanging out with smart people like Korchemny and Conte, I think he underestimated Conte in this camp. I think they thought Victor was having a hissy fit of some kind. And I think it's very telling now that you see, and it's kind of cool that we took a little break because I like to get let news breathe. People don't let news breathe and let it kind of you know, they always report the seeds. They don't ever wait for the flower, you know. And watching what they're doing with Robert Garcia, you know, Robert Garcia is saying kind of, you know, things might have to change unless Nonito comes down and really trains with me. He's kind of laying out his exit strategy of like, this isn't going to work for me. You know, my name's – basically they're hiring me to have my name on this really good product. But if the product's not going to be successful, I don't want my name on it. You know, and if you want – my name on it in the future, you're going to have to do things differently. I think those signs are there. And I think with Nonito, they underestimated Victor. Because, I mean, Robert Garcia said in the press, you know, Victor left Nonito over something silly. And I'm not being rude, but I think now he might rethink that quote. You know, I think he might have a different take on it. And maybe even want to hear Victor's side of it. I've heard both sides of it. They're very similar tales, but there's a common denominator, and I understand. I don't think it was something silly. I think it all points to a big change that needs to happen in Nonito's camp, and that he needs to focus in and be like a real fighter instead of Nonito Donaire superstar. He needs to the thing with Pacquiao, the thing with Mayweather, that's always a through line about them, no matter how big they get, is their work ethic is awesome every time. Even this last
fight,
Pacquiao was in great shape. He did not lose because he was in bad shape. He lost because he got caught, you know, by a great fighter. And it happened. So I think a lot needs to change with Nonito. Apparently he had the shoulder surgery. That got fixed. I mean, there's a time to release that information. If it's true, then, you know, just go have the surgery and say, hey, we got it done. Don't need to talk about when it happened or how many fights you've been suffering it with or how it affected things. I do think it did affect him. He throws the right, or used to throw the right, like a guy that was trying to save that shoulder. I knew about the injury. That's why I didn't rake him over the coals, though. The press, they get their information from one source, and they're so used to these days having to comment because they have a Twitter account. Instead of, like, laying back and, like, okay, Nonito just said that. Let's find out if he does have a shoulder injury. Then I'll give an opinion. Let's find out who his doctor is. You know, like, I had a lot of information when I wrote my piece heading into the fight. It was, you know, two visits to the gym. And obviously I'm kind of close to a lot of the players around that camp. And I picked Rigo, and as you did, to win. That should say something. He wasn't in great shape. He wasn't focused. He wasn't ready for this fight. Do I think he could win in a rematch? Absolutely. If he put everything together, he gives himself a very speedy, bigger guy puncher's chance, a high-level puncher's chance to win. He needs to be dynamic again, and he just wasn't. You know, he wasn't at all. He thought that 75% or 80% was good enough to beat Rigo, who I don't even know if 100% is. Rigo's a badass.
Yeah, you know, and that's what I was even saying. Even the Nonito Donaire of the past who had beat Big D'Artagnan, I don't know. I think it would be a little bit more competitive, but I don't think he would have been able to beat Rigondeaux. But then again,
Rigo,
you know,
the night of his life too. I mean, he was,
yeah, absolutely.
He was on
absolutely.
Point, dude. The left hand leads just bang bang after over and over again. You know, he landed. It's so interesting because you're going to jump to the Canelo fight, and I think there's a parallel between these two fights, in that Canelo fought much the way Rigondeaux did, long periods of inactivity, single shots that were accurate and hard. And yet, Rigo is called Rigondeaux, or Rigondeaux by
right.
people.
Or Rigondeaux.
Yeah. And so I say, well, why isn't Canelo called Rigondeaux? Because Rigondeaux gave me some yawns at times, I have to say. I don't know, something to think about. You know, it's like, because one guy is a franchise, he's Mexican, we're going to build on him. All of a sudden, you know, everything he does is great. And, oh, my God, look at that defense. And, oh, he's shaking his head in the middle of the ring, and Trout's not really doing anything. Well, neither is Canelo. He's not throwing punches.
But he sure was slipping a lot the way Rigondeaux was doing.
Yeah, it's very strange.
It was, you know what? Come to think of it, it was very similar. You know, here's the thing. Really quick, though. Fight fans, you want to call in, you certainly can. 347-215-7598. Call in and speak to us here. Let's talk some boxing here on Leaving the Ring. And make sure to download. Oh, man, I got the burpees over here. Make sure you download the mobile app to your iPhone or to your Android, the 2.0. I know we've been lagging on putting up the new shows and stuff, man. I apologize. By the time I get home, I'm just really burnt out. But we have been putting in a lot of work. If you haven't read the articles that have been posted on Leaving the Ring, go for it. You got to check it out. Brian Fogg, who's one of our investigators, along with Josh McDaniel and Barbara Pinella. Brian is a new addition, and his kid's a pet bull. Got Vernon Paris to talk about some real serious situations behind the scenes of his life, the obstacles he's definitely had to come across in order to be a fighter, and the obstacles he still has to come across. He's going to be showcasing on ESPN and return back to the ring after his loss to Zab Judah on May 10th. But anyways, let's go back. We'll get back into that. And we got to call our first guest in about a minute or so. Hopefully he's available because I didn't confirm whether or not he was going to come on. I was trying to get a hold of him, but I didn't get to say who we're going to have on. But we're just going to give it a shot and see if that long shot works. Going back with Canelo, and you know that we've been very critical of Canelo. You know, we called him a commercial Mexican franchise for boxing. Is this where Mexican fighters now are all going to become, like Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. and Saul Canelo Alvarez? And we had been pounding our fists on the table, had him on Leaving the Ring, and of course he hung up on us because of the questions. And those questions were, when are you going to fight somebody that's real? And he did. And I have to say, he shut all his critics up. I did pick Saul Canelo Alvarez to beat Austin Trout for a number of reasons. You know, I thought that for sure Canelo's combinations were going to be a little cleaner and smoother. But this is where I was surprised with Canelo. The head movement, the way he was able to slip punches, he showed a little bit more diversity, in my opinion, as a fighter. Did he fight in spurts? Absolutely. But that was nothing new. We've seen that. We saw him do from fight that he's been in, even though it was with smaller men, he fought at a very calm and normal pace. How well he does with a guy, and let's just talk about this for a moment. Austin Trout was a buzzsaw. But the problem with that buzzsaw, there was no teeth on that chain. Nothing to cut down the tree trunk at all. So Canelo was able to get brushed by leaves, not by the twigs.
Hmm. I mean, I think that Canelo always fights in that one gear. And it kind of got me thinking, listening to you. You know, a lot of these guys... Well, I don't know, though. I just kind of killed my own theory because Rios and Alvarado gained like 20 pounds, 18 pounds from the weigh-in to the fight. Canelo looks like he's all muscle. There's not a lot to lose, you know.
So solid kid.
Yeah, he really drains out, comes in, you know, like in the 70s. Both of them did, I believe. I wonder if that, but, you know, but then Trout turns around and throws so many punches. It's hard to say. I mean, I think Canelo just is kind of more of a counterpuncher by nature. You know, he's always been kind of not reluctant, but he'd rather have you miss and miss him to be patient, score his big shot. And if he can hurt you, cool. But he's just calm, cool, and collected in there. And for a young guy, and everybody always keeps saying, he's only 22, but for a guy that is only 22, he's very poised, man. He's faced already, I think this is his sixth current or former world champion. This is the first, you know, prime test. Austin was a solid test. I thought it was a close fight. You know, I had Trout winning, I have to say. I just thought they were playing. Yeah, I thought they were playing Trout's game a lot of the time, and I thought that Trout did better at playing his game. But, I mean, it's debatable. You know, it was not an easy fight to score. You know, I'm looking for my scorecard right now.
I had Canelo up by 1 point, one round.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, I like the telling punches in that fight. I like the accurate punches that Canelo was throwing. But here's my thought. What would have happened if James Kirtland was a bit more serious with his career and had followed through to fight Canelo? Because we saw with Austin Trout, he was busy. He was the go-for guy. He was going after him. He was applying the pressure. And Canelo was really, in my opinion, able to get away with a lot of those punches when they did land, because there was nothing there to make him humble. What would happen if he has a buzzsaw like a James Kirtland or Alfredo Angulo? Guys like that can come forward.
Well,
they're going to throw a lot of punches, and they're heavy, solid punches.
Well, James at his prime is, you know, his punches are actually, you know, from odd angles. Some of them are straight, some of them are looping, but they're frenetic and that pace. I don't know if James will ever get back there again, but
yeah.
But that's a, you know, we still got to get that interview. It's kind of weird. Like, I had him and then I lost him and then I don't know what's up. But with Canelo, I don't think people really get it. It's a rebuilding process.
Right.
I mean, it's a building process. And this is like not the safest guy that he could face because the style was difficult. But if you're going to face a difficult style, this is the one you want to face because you can't really punch. He's not going to catch you with something that's going to knock you out. Are you calling in?
I'm going to call him right now. Go ahead. I'm going to...
I think that what it is just the beginning of the progression, you know, here towards the elite level fighters. This is the guy you face. It's kind of like Oscar facing Ike Quarte, who could be dangerous, but was coming off a really long layoff, like 18 months, and he'd been sick during that period of time, making the weight after a long time, he was probably going to be a little drained, particularly late. And so it made him less dangerous than
right.
say, Felix Trinidad. And that was also the draw, so you're building towards that. And that's what Canelo's doing. I don't have a problem with the fight. I can even see how Canelo won. But I thought it was much closer, and we'll get into the judging later when it's not raining.
Let me see if he answers.
Hello, this is Big George Foreman. Take your time and leave a nice, clear message.
He said, you know what's funny? He had told our publicist, Red, that, hey, if I don't answer, just call me back again, or I'll try to call you back. I'm going to try one more time and see if we can get a hold of you. I called him then. That voicemail wasn't there. It was something else. He must have just done that. You got to love the voicemails that the fighters and ex-fighters, legend, Big George Foreman.
Hello, George.
Hello, Mr. George Foreman. This is Dave Duenas and Gabriel Montoya from Leaving the Ring Radio. We have a scheduled interview today.
Okay, how do you do?
I'm doing good. How you doing, sir?
Okay, can I give you a landline to call?
Sure. You know, we're on the air live. I don't know if I want to... can I text you for myself?
Well, okay, no. I'm doing it just as... this battery was about to call. But I can do it. I can do it. I'm ready when you are.
Okay. What I can do is I can text you from my cell phone right now, and then you can text me that landline number, and I'll call you right back. Does that work?
Hold on one second. One second.
Okay.
Okay. I'm gonna text you that number right now.
All right. I'll call you right back.
Right.
Yeah, that's your braver man than I am, Dave.
I know. Much haters that I have right now, they're going to be calling up my phone and blowing it up as usual. But that's all right. You know? You know what they say. If you ain't got haters, you're not doing something right.
That's true. That's very true. Better you than me. I would never do that. But, you know, Dave, I also wouldn't ever try to hunt you down or harass you in any way because you're much, much scarier than I am. So,
what are you trying to say? I'm an ugly guy? Oh, you know what now, man? I forgot to do is get myself some water and some food. I'm trapped, in this basement area. Golden Boy is just not treating me well at all. You know, my family's all the way in the back. My poor kids are waving at me. And they're like, hey, what's up? Anyways, what about that press conference? Zab Judah, you know what, man? I'm not picking Zab Judah to win this fight. But I got to tell you, you know, that I kind of feel for him. But at the same time, with me feeling for him, I'm also like, I can't fall into that trap with you, Zab Judah. I just can't. You know, I can't believe in you. Unfortunately, you know, it's just like that. It's that relationship with the person just keeps cheating and cheating and cheating and cheating, and they just don't want to change. So I got to be the smarter person to walk away and move on with my life, and that's pretty much what it comes down to with Zab Judah.
It's not you, Zab. It's us. I like Zab. He's fast. He's powerful. He's experienced. Talks some great trash. Today I thought was it was just an absolute gift to the boxing world. One of the great press conference moments of all time. I mean, one of the great speeches. He even did a variation on Tyson's "My Defense is Impregnable." You know, I mean, it was just beautiful. The way he backed off Oscar, the way he got Bernard Hopkins to kind of step back, like, nah, I'm from Brooklyn. If we were in Philadelphia, it'd be all good. And I've been there back in the day with you. Remember, I'm a champion too. You treat me like this in my hometown. And what was beautiful was that there they are in like this empty arena. It's not like there's a lot of, like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't really see a lot of the reports I just saw the video of kind of the close-up, and then there's another one that's out there that's a little further back. But it's like an empty arena. I think is that a harbinger of things to come? I mean, it was just, and then Oscar at the end taunting him, you know, Zab, he's from Brooklyn, all of Brooklyn, come out. Like, have you ever seen a promoter mock his own co-main event like that, a former champion? I mean, it was so disrespectful, but, you know, they talk about All Access. Dude, those videos were straight All Access. It was beautiful. I guess I lost Dave.
No, I'm here. I'm just I was texting Big George just to make sure he got my my number.
He did, along with J Rod and Memo Heredia and all the rest of the cast of Moron Island.
I'm being told that I guess when people call in, they're getting nothing but silence when they call into the show. You shouldn't have. I don't know. I have to send that in to Blog Talk to find out what's going on. And then they'll let us know what is the deal, why our callers can't call in. Call in the show and talk to us here on Leaving the Ring. 347-215-7598. Don't forget to download the mobile app and tune in and listen. That's if you can, because right now Blog Talk's having some problems. Now, what I thought was priceless was the face and the expression of Oscar De La Hoya. It was almost like catching the guy with his hand in the cookie jar. Zab Judah went up to him, and for a moment I thought that we were going to see a scuffle here. You know, Gabriel, I thought that Zab would have kind of went back what he did to Jay Nady. He's put the fist underneath Oscar's neck, but I think Zab remembered that Oscar's an ex-wife himself. You know what I mean?
Well, it was interesting, yeah, the eye contact and everything, and the way... You know, it's like Oscar is an ex-fighter. Yeah, he's dangerous. Like, out of all the promoters, it's like the one you don't want to mess with. But Zab's got his pride, too, and he's also like a fighter making weight. He's right in the thick of ready to fight. So Oscar knows you don't mess with a guy in that zone. You know, it was that, and he had no, what could he say? Yeah, we kind of jacked you. I mean, I wish I could say I'm shocked that nobody knew what was going on, and poor Zab seemed to miss his own press conference or something, or that the Garcias didn't want to be out there, and he's locked in a room with no water and everything. I mean, but I'm not surprised. You know, I've seen that sort of thing, that kind of confusion in those press conferences at Golden Boy. As much as I like those folks, I mean, I do, but there's chaos there. It's always going to the head person and saying, well, hey, what's going on? And, well, I don't know, and like always very frustrated, you know. Sorry to throw you under the bus, but you know, you've thrown me under the bus plenty of times, so I'm kind of done being nice. It doesn't surprise me where Zab was at.
No, you know what? It's funny because what Zab was, what he was ranting and venting out a bit here on that podium was something that we've kind of heard from other fighters that were challengers. You know, when we have had a chance to speak to other people. You know, even on the air and off the air, mostly off the air, I was told by a number of fighters, you know, like, hey, I was, you know, they made sure that I was uncomfortable. You know, they treated me like the second class citizen. And so that's not surprising. But here's another thing. It's not surprising to hear, but it's not just Golden Boy that does that. You know, Golden Boy is just not dirty when it comes to favoring their own fighter. So nothing surprises me anymore in this business of boxing, man. You know, it's just...
I don't know, though.
It doesn't make me shrug at all.
I don't mean to champion Golden Boy or champion Top Rank over Golden Boy in this situation. And I know, like, even on the smaller levels, like, you know, when a smaller promoter hires a opponent, that's basically what they're doing. You know, they're paying for an opponent. They got to fly him out and get him out there, you know. One guy will get the good treatment. The other guy might have two connecting flights out of a place that he shouldn't even be connecting to. You know, he might not have any food money. You know, they might starve him out in that last week and weaken him even more. Oh, they might have a little bit of hotel trouble, or his hotel's really far away from the fight venue. Little things like that. I'm sure that happens. That's just the game. But treating a guy like Zab Judah, who, say what you want about him, is good for the game and has always been good for the game, whether he's causing crazy headlines or things to erupt, he's been good for us. And he's a linear welterweight champion. We always talk about those things mattering. And a former junior welterweight champion. He should be treated in his hometown of Brooklyn with much more respect than he obviously was. That's just the facts. And there's just no excuse for it. Why wasn't his family allowed in there? What the heck? You know, like they're all have to sit in the back. How embarrassing. How rude. And I like that Zab called the press to task. Was like, look, this guy's dropping N-bombs about me? Really? In my hometown? And not one of you guys is saying, hey, wait a minute. You're crossing the line. You know, Zab might have been a bad guy when he was a young guy, when he went after Jay Nady. But in recent years, he's kind of practiced what he's preached. He's showed
up. Yeah, cleaned up his act a little bit.
Very much so. And so I think he deserves that respect. People are allowed to change. And his track record speaks for itself. Yeah, he'd maybe not win the big one, but he's given us some action fights. I think he deserves better than that. And so it was awesome to see. Good for him. He was the best reporter on Press Row today, without question.
He was. He really was, man. And a lot of emotions there when he was, you know, you could just see it. You know, he let loose. Here's the thing, too, with Zab Judah, even though he's cleaned up his act, but he's pretty much honest throughout his whole career. You know, he was pretty honest of how he was when he was younger. He really put his heart on his sleeve, and he continues to do that, but it's more of in a mature way. Even though the rant, some could argue that it wasn't that mature, but, you know, when push comes to shove, there's only so much pushing a person can take, and they're going to shove right back. There's only so many times you can, you know, pepper a guy, and he's not going to want to be salty at you. So I was okay with his rant. You know, I mean, let's remember Paul Imanagi. He went ballistic on Press Row with, I believe it was with Golden Boy, too.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people in the industry that say, you know, the minimum is their minimum is their maximum when it referring to their contracts.
Right.
You know, I mean, they're a young company. They're spread very thin, but there is an illusion that they're all powerful. And they're, you know, all those little shows, we've talked about this, those things cost money, man. The Fox shows, you might actually be breaking even or probably breaking even is more like it. You're not making a hand over fist. You're developing talent, and you're getting paid just enough to do that. It's very expensive to put on those smaller shows, as opposed to the big shows like, you know, a Rios Alvarado or whatever, those world championship boxing shows. Even the showbox shows, you're not making a hell of a lot of money. You're making good cable money, but it's not retirement money by any stretch of the imagination. It might you're lucky if it's, I don't have to work this year or half of the year kind of money. So Golden Boy, they're still young. They still make a lot of – they have this sense of entitlement. And it's grown more and more since they got their own network at Showtime. And there's a bit of an arrogance. I've experienced it, the way they kind of want to freeze out the media. And it's kind of funny text. I just think that the emperor wears, you know, the emperor's clothes were showing, basically, that the emperor wears no clothes. And here's this group that always is trying to control the media. Richard Schaefer, I mean, some of the things that reporters let him get away with saying. I, you know, as much as I guess it's publicized, I don't care for Rick Reno. It's with purpose because I care about this job. I didn't, you know, Memo Heredia has been going at me. You don't have no credibility. You know, you changed your name. Like I'm the first actor to ever do that. I can address that if people want me to. If they don't care, then, you know, they shouldn't because even my own family calls me Gabriel at this point. It's been my name for 20 years. But people say I have no credibility because I didn't go to school for this. I'm not a journalist. But you can learn on the job. I see a lot of guys on the Press Row without journalism degrees or with journalism degrees that don't take the chances that I do or stand up and interrupt a guy. If a guy is using you like a mouthpiece the way Richard Schaefer uses Rick Reno, where he doesn't really get challenged but rather kind of set up for softballs in interviews, you're really not a reporter. All you are is an extension of the PR machine. I think that's a big problem with the media these days is that guys do that. They take one side. I think that's the exclusive, and they're just happy to have had the conversation and for you to acknowledge that they had that conversation as opposed to getting to the facts, stopping a guy, interrupt. Don't be afraid to interrupt a guy. and say, well, that may not be true, or illuminate that, or what do you mean by that? I mean, I thought the way that Judah, who was armed with the truth of how he had just been treated, did a great job with not letting Oscar De La Hoya get away with it by smoothing it over. Well, here you go. Here's your chance. Talk, man. No, he deserved more than that. And he was armed with the truth, and you saw how Oscar had no defense. He got quiet and backed off. That's what it looks like when you're a reporter and you're armed with the truth and somebody tries to brace you and you say, nah, bullshit. This is the truth. Reporters should take note of that moment. It was a very powerful thing watching the whole interview.
It was.
Watching the whole rant. And for that very reason, that's what Balls looks like, in case anyone was wondering.
Let's pass in some Fight fans. They've been trying to get on and they get dropped off and stuff. Let's see if we can get one through right now. Area code 347, you're on live right now, Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind? 347, you there? No.
What happened to George?
He hasn't texted me back. I don't know what's going on. So I did text him. So I don't know. I think I might have said it too fast or who knows. I have Red giving him a ring right now, trying to find out what's going on. I think we might have caught him off guard. It was scheduled, but like I said, he didn't confirm it. I didn't have time. But let's see. We'll give him another shot in a short bit here on Leaving the Ring. Fight fans, I apologize if you can't tune in, if you're calling in on 347-215-7598. Download the mobile app on your iPhone or your Android here on Leaving the Ring. So, Omar Figueroa, man, does this kid, let me ask you this. When have we seen a kid look that young, have that heavy of hands, and really have a face expression that he just loves to hit people?
I hate to say the words, but I haven't been this excited. I think most of boxing, Panchito Bajado, remember how young he was?
Oh, yeah.
And he was just the real deal. I mean, like combinations, I mean, just fluidity. He seemed to have a high IQ.
Yep.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, I don't think he, I don't wish that fate on Omar, but he seems to be the real deal, like superstar in the making. Every time he fights, you got to see him, just explosive. You know, I think as it steps up, we'll really find out about his power and if he can take a punch and all those other questions. But there's few guys in the sport who I want to see answer those questions more than him.
You know, Panchito Bojado was obviously very accurate, quick. He had really good boxing fundamentals. I liked him a lot. Omar Figueroa got he's just ferocious. I know where you're going with that. I just say that Panchito was just a little bit more polished. I would like to see Omar be a bit more polished, kind of see where he's at in terms of just seeing that second gear of levelness. Can he go to that second gear? Because we're not really sure how well he does against a guy that can move, a guy that's going to be able to take his punch, and a guy that's going to be able to slip and give him a counterpunch and make him think. You know, what Omar Figueroa, what he reminds me of is the guy that doesn't want you to think. Because once he allows you to think, he gets in trouble. So there's a red flag there. Even though we like that, in your face, get you out of there quick, make you stand up and applaud because we're that, you know, blood-curdling audience. You gotta take a step back as a boxing fan, a person that loves the sport, that likes to watch the styles and why we have styles and why matchmaking sometimes is very difficult where it can blow up in your face. With Omar Figueroa, there's a kid that we have to find out whether or not the power is going to get him through to that second or third tier level of fighters. And we find out whether Omar Figueroa's power can be substituted with some IQ, some ring generalship.
No, I think he's, you know, he's going to be, he's raw. I mean, I don't mean him, that he reminds me of Panchito in that sense, but in terms of a guy that's guaranteed action that I think has a long career ahead of him, you know, of those kind of action fights, maybe not that long, but certainly it's going to be an entertaining streak. That's what I think of. Like, I remember seeing Panchito on the Showbox and just, I don't know, being excited by him. Just really from the first fight, I'm trying to think what network I actually did see him on. And
Showtime?
I don't know. I don't know if that was the first time. Was he? How many Showtimes did he have?
You know what?
And where's Big George Foreman?
I don't know. I don't know what happened with Big George here.
Oh, well.
I don't think we scared him off. He's too big for us to scare off. why don't you go ahead and give your thoughts here for I'm gonna call George on my cell phone line and see if I can get that landline number he wants us to call.
You got it. I'm actually in the middle of setting up our next guest, which is actually very exciting to me. But which fight were we talking, Dave? Do you want to go back into Canelo Trout? Do you want to look forward to this weekend's bouts? The one I'm looking kind of forward to out of all of them is probably Fernando Guerrero and Peter Quillen. I think it's an interesting matchup just because the two guys
trying to get that man line for you so we can get you on the air.
This is like all access, leave it in the ring. Just 1 second, folks. We're actually at the same time, Dave, we're doing the exact same thing.
So it's 281-360-70. Okay, I'll call you
right now. Thank you. Okay, you there? I am. Sorry, I'm getting our next guest after that, Lamont Peterson, kind of in queue.
Okay, let me call Big George here. I got his number. So let's call him in really quick, and let's talk to the big man himself. And he didn't get my text, so that's what happened.
So we'll have Lamont at 6:15.
George.
Hey, George. Dave Duenas here and Gabriel Montoya on Leaving the Ring Radio. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us here.
Thank you for having me.
George, well, I got to tell you, man, it was a delight. It was a lot of fun hearing you back on the commentator seat, doing your thing, because as a fight fan, after you left, it felt really strange not to hear you talk and break down fights the way you used to.
I had so much fun doing it, and the strangest thing in the world is having a bit of knowledge about something and not sharing it. You know, it's just like being an auto mechanic and not having to touch a car.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you get to watch him drive on by, and you just sit there and go, you know, I could really put some work to that there.
I think, and concerning those automakers, we all could help them.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because, you know, you said you got this knowledge, and you know, you're not able to give your opinion or your breakdown. Is that a bit frustrating? I mean, do you keep up with the sport? Do you channel in to see what's going on out there with the fighters, especially with the heavyweights around the world?
Oh, if you keep up with the heavyweights, you'll be depressed constantly. There aren't any good heavyweights anymore. There are great middleweight and lightweight fighters. I mean, great ones, not just to mention one, two, or three. The division is loaded with the lighter weight fighters, but in the heavyweight division, there's nothing. That's why even in the middleweights, it's getting a little shaky. The guy who won the championship the other day, what's his name? 48 years old.
Bernard.
When I was in boxing, I could have been boxing. I was going to make a comeback at 55, and I'm arguing with my wife because she told me, you're not doing anything like that. I said, I can still do it. I said, I can guarantee the number one contender $5 million to fight me, then I'll beat him, and she said, you're not going to do it. I said, you don't believe I can do it? She said, yeah, I believe it, but isn't that the way you want to leave the sport?
Somehow, it's always our women in our lives.
Can you imagine a 55-year-old man could have still been heavyweight champion of the world if I had so chose?
Wow.
Do you think you would have been competitive with the Klitschkos early on, even at that late stage, just because?
Yeah, those guys are really good. Now, I'm not going to knock them at all, especially the younger one, Vladimir. He's a good fighter. You can't take anything away from him. It's not like you wake up, go to bed at night and say, I wish I could fight Klitschko. No. He's a tough cookie. But, you know, the idea is that if you close your eyes, anyone, and say to yourself, here's this guy in one corner and Foreman in the other corner, who's going to run? And if your answer is logical, you'll know that where the division stands. You know, I couldn't be heavyweight champ of the world now. I mean, I eat too much. Two rounds and I'd be out of breath.
Well, I mean, you were in your prime. Well, in that second prime, you were pulling trucks with a harness around you and chopping wood and doing all everything you needed to do. What was the difference, though, for you, do you think, between your early career and that career? I mean, did you do things different conditioning, or was it a spiritual and mental transformation for you?
Well, I had to change total styles. I'd gotten back in the gym after 10 years out, and I try to keep my hands up and stop and parry like I did when I fought Frazier and other champions. And I put my hand up, and those younger guys would hit me before I could get my hands out there. So I had to bring my hands closer to my arms, closer to my body, and keep them in one position, learn a cover-up style. And then I didn't run from anyone or move at all. I sort of just churn in place. And I had, from running 3 miles as champion of the world of previous time, I started running 15, 16 miles because I needed stamina, pulling trucks, because I knew if someone knocked me down, everyone would scream, "Don't let that old man up, stop the fight." So I couldn't afford to get knocked down. I never was knocked off my feet the second time.
That's true. I mean, and you absorbed some punishment for some real punchers. I mean,
that one time, Evander Holyfield was supposed to have hit me 50 times straight. And when his last punch landed, I looked at him and said, "Let's go, buddy." He started holding on to me.
I think any man will hold on to you, George, if you're going to come and hit them, you know?
Yeah, he was holding on in the last round. And, the point is, I didn't win. I lost that fight by a few points, but I made the point that the age 40 and even 50 is not a death sentence if you really believe in yourself.
Let me ask you this, George, because you know you're a religious man and you left the sport. You start your own sermon and then you came back. What do you think about fighters that put all their faith into the religion, but then they mix it up with boxing? Is that difficult to dedicate yourself? Because, you know, this may be a little bit controversial. I don't know if you want to answer this, but, you know, in the Bible it says you can't serve two masters.
And I tell people I am not an evangelist for boxing. I'm an evangelist for God.
Absolutely.
And Jesus Christ. I mean, I don't preach boxing. If I had been a golfer, I would have loved coming back to golfing. If I had been a tennis player, don't you think I'd been back playing tennis to this day?
Right.
I was a boxer. It's a profession. As a matter of fact, it's the godfather of all professions. You wouldn't have ping pong if you didn't have boxing. And it's the granddaddy. I went back to boxing not to prove that I was tough, but to feed my family. And anyone that has a profession should be allowed to practice it to bring those baskets back. Now, I have five boys all named George. They could eat anything but an excuse.
Oh, yeah.
I had to put bread on the table.
So do you think it's...
I didn't love boxing. I just loved my profession. I was grateful to have a profession.
And the reason I'm asking you this is because you have Robert the Ghost Guerrero, who's a very religious person, who I know personally. I've known him for quite some time, him and his family. And it seems like, though, because they're doing that all access on Showtime, but I've noticed that there, and I've spoken to some media and even fight fans that are just really turned off with him talking about God most of the time. Do you think that more people are just they're being arrogant and they're not accepting that this is what this man believes and they should kind of, you know, I mean, isn't that good for the sport in some way?
I think there are a lot, and there have been a lot of other boxers in the sport who spoke more horrible things than religion. If I was going to choose what subjects a boxer would talk, I would prefer religion. Even if he had it wrong, it would be a lot better than the right some of the other bad people are talking. I congratulate him. I hope that not only he can keep his religious walk, but even make it better when his boxing day is over, because we only have a few days to box anyway.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Such a short career. Even if you're good, just so happened. You know, I was heavyweight champ of the world at 45, and that was 1994. How long that's been ago?
Yeah.
I mean, a record was broken, but there are a lot of guys who just graduated and got their master's in education since that day. PhD they're working on. Time moves on.
You know, you talked earlier about the heavyweight division being depressing, and we've
it's
kind of lost those guys. There's a lot of people say, you know, there's theories of they went to MMA or they went to football, basketball. But don't you think that on some level, at least as it pertains to kind of the poorer class, which is where boxing gets its fighters from, particularly the African-American community, that if we ignore what the drug war and the prison industrial complex has done to those communities, generations just devastated by ridiculous drug laws that have torn families apart, do you think on some level that has to do with kind of thinning the group, the talent pool of people? I mean, I hear too many times, oh, this guy was great, but jail in the street got him. Do you think on some level that has to be a part of the problem?
Well, that's something to think about, but remember, some of the greater champions of the world had been former prisoners. Sonny
right.
Liston spent half of his life in jail. So that doesn't prevent a heavyweight from becoming heavyweight champ of the world, going to jail. As a matter of fact, that may cultivate it.
Yeah, Bernard Hopkins. Yeah.
I mean, because you get locked up in jail, and the one thing you have, those laws that make you feed those guys properly. Some of the guys spend 5 or 6 years in jail, come out looking like Hercules. And they 10 years, and they are Hercules. So, I mean, that doesn't prevent anyone from becoming champion of the world. And then they have boxing programs where they can learn to box and everything. It just so happened that boxing was so popular at one time. You were heavyweight champ of the world. You were king of the world. Remember the original Golden Boy. Then Rocky Marciano, Floyd Patterson, Joe Louis. These were popular people, but they didn't have anything to compete against. Now we have soccer stars. That guy from Europe, he's come over and he's got a following in soccer. You also have the baseball players. They're with the baggy pants. It's lovely now. And we see
yeah.
them on television. Football, NBA, a guy dunks the ball and he's on a million pair of sneakers. Boxing has lost its popularity because there hasn't been a popular champion.
You think it's as simple as we need a heavyweight that's American, that's charismatic, that knocks people out?
You got it. I couldn't have said it better. I'm glad it came from your mouth. Then, once we get that, you'll have every boxing gym in the world ringing with heavyweights because of popularity. Young people don't follow sports because they love a particular sport. We follow them because we fell in love with the star. Muhammad Ali, as a youngster, was singing. He was making songs and poems. He was a folk hero. Made everybody want to become a boxer. Even guys in the gym were getting knocked out. They said, but I still want to be Ali. Because he was so popular. Then the popularity and then press agents started writing and giving names to other athletes and fighters or prospective fighters went on to other sports.
When you had a fight, Ali, did you want to be him at that moment?
Did I want to beat him?
No, did you want to beat him? You know, he said everybody wanted to be
Ali. You know, I'm going to tell you something, though. The saddest thing, even for Joe Frazier and a lot of other athletes, you think you'd beat Muhammad Ali and wake up the next day and be him. You're right. No one could become him. And that's what a lot of times people are fighting to become, not the heavyweight champion of the world, but to become Muhammad Ali. He was born who he is. And a lot of people had a lot of problems. He was the most. He was a handsome. And he spoke so well, and he had poems, and he was exciting, made your heart beat when you see him. And a lot of fighters, as you said, you hit the nail right on the head. A lot of people wanted to be Muhammad Ali. I just wanted the money.
Yeah, I think also because the fact that he was an entertainer, but George, don't you think that the reason we don't have athletes can't be Muhammad Ali right now is because of the time of error? I mean, in that time when he was doing his thing, there was so much stuff going on that it was I wouldn't say it was easy to jump on a subject, but he was obviously getting on subjects that were very touchy in those times, right?
Oh, yeah. He became a folk hero. And remember, we only had three television stations, NBC, ABC, and CBS. Trying to be something today with all of the different radio stations and television stations, you have to really be something special.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the comment that Muhammad Ali made about the Viet Cong, you know, and when he didn't, those things became, because there was no multimedia coverage and the 24-hour news cycle didn't exist like it did today, you know, today he would tweet that, and probably 20 minutes later or 30 minutes later he'd apologize because that's what his handlers told him to do, and it would be very PC and we'd be on to the next story.
Yeah, they call it the weapon of mass destruction now is the microphone. You can destroy everything with your big mouth today because it's on air. It's all over the world, any mistake you make. And you can change it quickly. You can make it so not destructive instantly as well.
Yeah, a quick apology and, you know, we don't care anymore. I think...
Yeah. Because all you have to do is say something, your agents and all your publicity people get together and say, say this, and it's rectified.
Yeah, the information.
And Muhammad Ali suffered greatly, but, you know, he was a man of integrity. Even to this day, I speak with him. His daughters will call me up and put him on the telephone, and I speak with him. He still has his integrity. If you catch him early in the day, he's strong and has a lot of things to say.
Wow.
He has a sense of humor, I imagine, too.
Man, he's still so funny. You know, he's bright. He's extremely sick, but he is as bright as can be.
Let me ask you this. Is he carrying a George Foreman grill in the house? Have we checked on that?
I made sure of that quickly. I start taping and sending boxes to him from the day one. Make sure you use this grill.
You know who would be a happier guy, George? I don't know if you've seen him, but you know who would be a happier guy? Because every time I see this guy on YouTube or I've seen him in the gym, is Michael Moore. He's just not that happy. I think you need to send him a George Foreman grill.
I will do it. We've been speaking lately as well. As a matter of fact, he's trying to put together a television show where we're going to Europe and try to develop the next heavyweight champion of Europe. And to put it in a television show. So Michael Moore and I are really good friends.
Let me ask you really quick. You've been in a unique position in that your career has spanned decades and generations. But you've also been on both sides of the curtain in terms of the media. In your opinion, how has coverage of boxing changed for the better and worse from the time that you were a champion?
For the worse, we don't have writers anymore.
Hmm.
You see, everything has to occur in writing first. Then it has to be interpreted as far as the mass media, but it must have a writer. They were the one who gave us the Louisville Lip, the Bear, the Rabbit, Big George Foreman. You know,
right.
They gave us these names, the Brown Bummer.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these guys, Jack Dempsey, all of us were given names by the writers. They made it romantic. The writers retreated a little bit, and now we don't have anything. You know, you must, it has to be seen in writing first. And that's how we, and the reason we suffered. The writers deserted us.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm a writer.
The writers give us names. They just write about us. If you write about us, we'll make it. That's, you saw in what happened to, they went on a writer's strike in Hollywood 1 year, and television hadn't gotten back to itself yet because the writers they started putting together shows without writers. Come in with stuff like reality shows. Reality shows mean really bad writing.
So you think a lot of this kind of, reality shows, that was actually what killed us. We haven't, culture hasn't recovered from the reality show because it's cheaper.
But they try to do it without paying the writers, and they end up with a junky thing. So bring back the writers for boxing, keep it in television. Of course, it stayed alive in the movies because you write the script writers and all of that. But you need writers. We all need writers.
That's an interesting criticism. I think in terms of the fighters themselves, what do you think is deficient?
Well, you just can't be heavyweight champ of the world without a dream. And a lot of guys today just are without need. You see them walking around with two diamond earrings. I mean, real diamonds. And they're not thinking about one day I'm going to be heavyweight champ of the world and get a diamond earring. They already have one.
yeah,
that's true.
You got to have, and then, there's no distinction in a car. You can see one car. There was a time when Sugar Ray Robinson had a pink Cadillac. Every kid would drool. One day I'll have a pink Cadillac. And that the darling, and really the golden boy, Oscar De La Hoya, boy, he brought the life boxing. Women screaming. And as he winged off, a whole era starts to perish.
That's true. Yeah, we don't have the guy that brings the women as much. Sergio Martinez could, but if he spoke more fluid English, I think it would be a little easier to market him. But he also marketed De La Hoya over a long period of time.
He was marketed a period of time. Can you believe I was with Top Rank, and they asked to do my boxing match, and they wanted to, you can use George if you let Oscar fight on the undercard. Can you believe that? Now, Oscar, he just made boxing what it is today as far as pay-per-view. He brought him in, let me tell you.
Wow.
He carries the sport on his back for a long time. And say what you will about his company or whatever and the top-ranked Golden Boy war that's going on. Oscar carried the sport. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think it's great in terms of competition breeds better fights, a better product?
Yeah, what I'm so happy about is a great promoter in Bob Arum and a great ex-boxer promoter in Oscar De La Hoya. This is splendid. A guy who leaves the sport and becomes a major provider of major entertainment in boxing. On national TV and cable TV, Oscar De La Hoya. I'm so proud. Boxing needed this.
I think it is.
Boxers are fighting it out, but can you imagine a boxer, promoter, fighting it out with a promoter and no fists are being thrown?
And the promoter that pretty much helped develop him, that created him.
Yeah.
It's an innate storyline.
You can't develop a boxer and then tell him, don't get as big as I am, please.
Yeah. It's been interesting watching them kind of interact.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you, George? Where do you go from here?
Well, my boys have taken on promotion. We formed a promotional company as promoters now, boxing promoters, forming boys promotions. And we're promoting a boxing show in Austin this Saturday night.
Oh really?
So there's boxing going on now, and I'm a part of it in a promotional end. My son, it's a family business, and they didn't want to get in there and get beat up, so I said, okay, promote.
that's a smarter. It's always smarter to be on the other side, don't you think?
Yeah.
I agree.
Is this going to be televised, George, or is this?
It'll be on. I think it's Telemundo.
Oh, wow, I look forward to it then. It's going to be Saturday night then.
Yeah, and this guy, Beltran, is one of the highlighters of the fight.
Oh, Ray Beltran? Okay, yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about there. Well, George, I thank you again for taking the time to talk to us here on Leaving the Ring Radio. I hope we can do this again. Again, I thank
Anytime.
You very much.
Anytime. You guys have my number. Call me up. Let's chat.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolute honor. Thank you so much, George. Take care. Yeah. All right.
Had Big George Foreman here on
Big
Leaving
George
the Ring. Big George Foreman in his grill here on Leaving the Ring Radio. You know, at first I didn't think he understood the question when you asked him about the Cold War, and he was like, it's great for boxing. But he did, and he thinks it's great.
Well, I mean,
I think he thinks it's healthy being competitive, and I think he agreed with you when you were saying it brings out higher level competition in the matchmaking.
Yeah, and I think on some level, I mean, we're missing out on fights, but they're going to have to roll out a good product, and when they run dry, we'll see what happens. But for now, they're going to have to roll out their best guys in order to keep everybody appeased. It's going to be interesting to see how people feel. I mean, everything is kind of broken correctly for Danny Garcia versus Zab Judah. The postponement that kind of made Zab mad. They've kind of just irritated Zab this whole time until he's just flat out angry.
I remember one time.
Ray Beltran is on Uno Mas this
Uno
weekend.
Uno Mas, right. But you, hey, come on, let's be honest here, Linus. Were we going to correct him? That's Big George Foreman.
Yeah, seriously. Like, look, he should have it all there. You know, this is promotion. We're about to have Lamont Peterson on. Just working it out. Is everybody, how's the link working? I know we're...
It's not the link that's broken or anything like that.
Well,
it's the call-in number that they're calling in, but they can't hear us talk.
You know what the problem is they haven't downloaded the Leave It in the Ring mobile app. That's
you need to
the
download
problem.
The mobile. Yeah, you do.
That's really the problem. All right, so I'm setting up the next tweet. He said, Lamont's just finishing up in the gym. He'll be with us at 9:15, his time, 6:15, our time, about 8 minutes. So almost done with my salmon. It was delicious, just in case you were wondering, Dave. I'm a lot of things. A hell of a cook is one of them. I got credentialed for May Day, and guess what? I'm going to have to decline it because I got a wedding that day. Nope, not going, not caring. I just think the more I look at the fight, the more that promotion's breaking, Mayweather-Guerrero. I mean, I don't know, sometimes less is more. I'm like watching all this coverage, and it's all very controlled. It's all very, you know, all access, quote-unquote. Today was all access, seeing behind the scenes. Radio Raheem of Max Boxing's video where he shows himself not unable to get a one-on-one. And as it turns out, when you watch All Access Episode 3 around the 9-minute mark, Floyd goes on a rant about the media and how they're trying to divide him and his father and his uncle and all this stuff. And the music gets kind of ominous. And there's like 3 or 4 shots of Radio Raheem, our reporter, who did an interview with Roger where they were talking about, you know, a disagreement over who was going to be in the corner. And Roger refused to concede that he wasn't the head trainer anymore. And it was very clear what happened. They were upset about that.
Oh, yeah. He was vocal about it, you know, absolutely, yeah, I agree with you.
So, you know, I am a little bit bummed that I won't be able to see, you know, our good friends there in Vegas, and there's certainly some people on press row that I can't wait to see, but they're going to have to come to L.A. to my turf for that to happen, I guess, on this one. It just isn't, you know, I'm a guy that pays my own expenses, and when it comes to travel, and I'm not about to, I get to write it off at the end of the year or what have you, but... I'm not going to spend my money for a fight where I already know who's going to win. And Floyd Mayweather's going to win. It's going to be a close.
Oh, we're
going to
argue
fight.
With that one there, buddy.
I think Floyd's going to win.
Yeah, Robert. I'm picking Robert here. It's going to be a tough match. It's going to be a fight that absolutely he's going to be, you know, he's going to have to go through the fire. And he's – but I think he can pull it off, man. I really think he can – pull it off. But I've been wrong before. It's not the first time. It's okay. But
well,
hey, I've been right lately, though. Let's get out there.
But here's the scary thing. We've both been very right. Although you did pick Canelo, I went with Trout. Actually, I don't know. We didn't have an official pick. Who did you pick?
I did. I picked Canelo to win.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's on Twitter. People respect my expertise on Twitter, like that guy from Facebook.
Oh my God! Yeah, look, I'm very well respected in Cleveland. You know, it's like what?
Hey, in the porta potties, whatever I write on the walls, buddy, they respect me. My knowledge is solid in the porta potties at work. Trust me. Hey, you know what? We're talking about a great month of boxing. We're being spoiled. Fight after fight, fight after fight. Zab Judah, Danny Garcia are going to get back, and they're going to get in their mix. The buildup of it, if anything, Zab has sold this fight. He's actually got me want to watch this fight. Not just him, Angel Garcia, who's Danny Garcia's father, is a guy. And, you know, there's a lot of mixed feelings about Angel Garcia. We've talked about this here on Leave the Ring. We've had a chance to meet him. In person, face-to-face, and have conversation with him. And what people perceive of him when he's going off on cameras and what you get a chance to talk to the man in a more quiet setting, you get more of a, I wouldn't say thoughtful, but a more conservative approach of how he looks at things in boxing with the honesty that he likes to not push, but shine. He likes to throw out there the truths in boxing. And I've really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed conversations with him. But he's a guy that knows how to sell his son. He's a guy that knows how to sell Danny Garcia to the public. And it kind of surprises me how some folks are not getting that. They're really taking it to even Zab. I mean, am I the only one that has forgot how Zab has gotten in the past to sell fights? You know, he's a hyper kid. And I can call him a kid because I'm way older than him. I think I'm, maybe 6 years older than him and then Zab Judah. But he's had to sell fights, and he's definitely sold this fight. But it's kind of ironic that you're seeing an older gentleman get underneath the skin, in the mind. The way Virgil Hunter does to other fighters. Virgil Hunter has gone in the mind of fighters for Andre Ward. And here's the difference is that Virgil Hunter is more of a subtle. He's got a subtle approach where Angel Garcia is a brat. He just blasts the opponent. But they're both doing their job as trainers. They're softening up the opponent before they get into the ring so that their fighter is able to get off what they've been working on in camp. And I think that's, even though Zab Judah's a veteran and he's a professional, I think that he's kind of shown that Angel Garcia has kind of won the verbal warfare between them. He's kind of won that first round, in my opinion, Gabe. I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but the Andy Garcia rant, the Andy Garcia throwing out his tantrums and is making his comments, and are some of it appropriate? Absolutely not. But like I said, his approach is almost the same mental approach, the way Virgil Hunter breaks down a fighter. Let's not forget what Virgil Hunter had to say about Arthur Abraham, what he's had to say about Kessler, Psycho Bika, Carl Froch. He mentally had broke them down, made them question themselves and get them out of their game plan.
Yeah, it's like, remember what Danny said, and it was the thing I printed this week. Back in December, we talked to him, and he said, you know, if my dad was making up stories, I'd be mad, but he's telling the truth, and the truth hurts. And I think it's unraveled Judah to hear, hey, man, you're kind of always been a four-round fighter, or you can't really go over the long haul. Even though Zab has had some big wins past the fourth round, and he was the linear heavyweight champion. Those things are hard to hear. When you've been stopped, it's embarrassing. That hurts your pride. And to have some dude coldly point out that happened and it's going to happen again, that's got to upset you. But, I didn't hear Angel drop the N-bomb, so I'm not going to even speak to that. If he did, way over the line. But this is warfare. And you look at the Art of War, and you talk about Virgil Hunter. He's a guy that loves the Art of War, loves to play those games. You get to define what your battleground is and what your lines are, what your front line is, you know, everything. You don't let the opponent decide that. So if Zab thinks it's over the line, well, then you probably staked your territory just right. So, I mean, it is what it is. It's warfare. And Zab has an opportunity to shine and upset the apple cart in Brooklyn, where it all started, where he lives his life every day. Let's see what's up. You know? It's going to be an interesting fight. I don't know if it's completely turned me around and say, you know, now we're going to see the real Zab Judah. I think we have. We know him pretty intimately at this point. We're going to see Zab Judah. Will it be enough to beat Danny Garcia? We'll see.
I don't know. You know, obviously, sometimes you don't want to wake up a giant, but that giant, if he's asleep too long, he could wake up a bit old and off. His timing could be off. I know, you know, Zab has had his moments, but when we've seen him at this level of competition, he's never walked away the victor. He did the Harlem Shake against Costa Zoo. He was asleep when he fought Spinks the first time. He couldn't pull it off with he had his moment with Floyd Mayweather Jr., but just couldn't make it until he had that without having a mental breakdown. But then again, you know, you dare to be great. You dare to have that one last victory march. Can Zab Judah do? Can he do? Can he be the doer? I don't know. But I got to tell you, like I said, you know, we've broken up many times, and I just don't trust him anymore, Gabriel.
No. No, it's you know, it isn't you, it's him. I have to say, you know, he's the one that's just going to let you down. I the last, for me, was the Khan fight. That was it. Even with the Vernon Parris win, I'm like, yeah, okay, he can win at that level. But Amir Khan really picked him apart. I mean, Danny doesn't fight like that. Zab's going to be able to get inside, and probably the speed is going to bother him a little bit. But is Zab faster than Amir? We'll see. Is he more explosive?
I think he's
probably
fast. And he's a little bit more. I think his punches are a little bit more tight.
Oh, they're on the line right now, Lamont Peterson's people.
Okay, let me see if I can patch him in.
You know,
Lamont, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, brother. We were having some technical problems.
Yeah,
we weren't sure if we were going
to hear people. You know, our people late last minute, so
yeah,
I ain't worried about it. It's only 2 weeks. That's when they buy their stuff.
They don't
buy stuff.
You guys are live. Just warning you.
Yeah.
Hello.
So
hello. You guys there?
By tomorrow, what the hotel going to cost?
Hello.
They're going to give us. We're going to learn.
No, they can't hear us.
Okay.
Yeah. You're going to have to let me tell them that we're going to have to call them in order to make this work. I'll call him in right now. Just text him for me. Because that's not going to work. Right now, I'm actually getting... Block Talk is saying they're experiencing some problems.
Yeah, they're experiencing being Block Talk. Do you need the number, or do you have it?
I have the number right here in front of me. That's what I'm saying. Go ahead and just text him.
Okay.
And I can... I can call him in right now. Lamont Peterson here with us on Leaving the Ring Radio. And I'm calling him in right now. I think this is Andre's number that I'm calling.
Hello?
Andre, this is Dave Duenas and Gabriel Montoya from Leaving the Ring Radio.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Gabe. Hold on. Let me get Lamont on.
Okay,
great.
Okay. We apologize to our listeners, but I know.
Oh, sorry, man. Sorry.
Okay, cool.
Hi, Lamont. How are you? How are you doing this evening?
He's not on yet.
Oh, I thought that was him. Oh.
That was Andre.
That was Andre again?
That was Andre. I was calling Andre's cell phone.
You guys keep messing with me.
I know. Hey, I really like that background you got, man, for your for the new TR.
Hey, Gabe, Dave?
Yes.
Yes.
Lamont's on the line.
Lamont, right. What's up, bro?
Ain't nothing. What's going on?
Man, you were looking beasty that last fight, dude. You looked like you wanted it. I fought for a minute. You know what? If they didn't put that, they should have put that scream and that intensity on 3D on ESPN, man, because you would have came out of that scream.
Yeah.
You know, that was something else. That was something else, man. Talk about being restrained and it just showed how much you missed the ring and the gift that you gave fight fans for the knockout Kendall Holt like that. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a big splash and let people know I was back. But that's what happened. You know, I knew, you know, that fight would lead on to, you know, big and better things, and that's why this matchup we got, you know, coming up May 18th with Lucas Matisse is happening.
You know,
I constantly want to give the fans the fight that they want to see. It seemed like everybody was pointing at him, so that's where we went.
You wanted to give a big splash, and I'm pretty sure you left that pool, that pool of water half empty or half full, however you want to look at it, because that's exactly what you did. It was a major splash. You made fight fans start talking again. And the Lucas Matisse's fight, though, here's a fight that I think a lot of us are thinking it's a 50-50 fight. Because here's a puncher, and here's a guy that's been improving in his boxing skills, but still leaves himself with opportunities to be caught, opportunities to be outboxed. You obviously can't do what you did at Kendall Holt. Two different fighters, two different styles, and two different game plans. But have you gotten track on watching him, watching tapes, and studying what Lucas Matisse brings?
Yeah, of course. You know, with every fighter that I get in the ring with, I do my homework. And to me, you know, everybody, you know, always said, you know, he's a slugger, hard puncher. You know, he seemed like he got, you know, pretty decent puncher power. But to me, you know, they don't talk too much about his technical skill. And to me, he's kind of underrated in that department. I think he throws, you know, good, solid punches. He knows what he's doing in there. And so I'm just preparing for, you know, a good, tough fight. And I just know I'm going to be victorious.
Were you – hey, Lamont, this is Gabriel.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, man. Thank you for coming on, especially right after training. Were you surprised? Just tell me your thoughts about when the test came back and it was a, you know, an inconclusive result or whatever. It wasn't a positive or a negative, but it was an irregularity. And they tried to get pinned on you, and then here we go again. You seemed, you know, in the media anyways, you seemed calm and collected, and you just let the storm pass right by you. Can you just speak to that, how you felt when that all started to break?
Nothing in boxing surprises me at this point.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whatever happens, you know, I know this is what I signed it to now. So, you know, I kind of just, you know, take it on the chin and keep walking, just like as if I was fighting. I knew at the end of the day I didn't do anything, so there was no need to worry. I knew that, you know, everything would come out just like it did the first time, and, you know, I would be okay. And if not, and if there was, you know, something that they was going to put on me or whatever the case may be, then, you know, that was something I was going to have to deal with. You know, I'm in it. Always been a guy who, you know, take life, pay it on. And whatever comes my way, I'll deal with it. And that's what I was going to do in that situation. Well, that's what I did. I just dealt with it. And it just so happened that they straightened things out pretty fast, and I didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a busy news day, certainly for me. You know, it's one of those things, especially now you've been through it the first time, and it just shows how we've got to be diligent when we cover those stories, because that's your reputation, you know, and you're
right.
Working hard to fix it. Let's move into this fight. Let's move into positive territory here. No pun intended. Lucas Matisse is probably the most dangerous guy in the division in terms of he's considered to be the biggest puncher in the division. Talk to me about facing that guy. What challenges do you see? Is that the only thing you see that makes him dangerous?
Nah, I'm more worried about his skill set than his punch power. But at the end of the day, this is what we signed up for. We're going to take some punches and we're going to give some. So I'm not worried about no punch. I mean, that's just part of the game. But, you know, like I said before, he's underrated in the technical skill part, and I think he comes out with a good game plan, and he does well in there. You know, when he's fighting, not like he's just out there just throwing punches. He knows what I think he knows what he's doing. So I just have me and my team. We got a good game plan that I just have to go out there and execute. And I think if I do that, I shouldn't have any problems in the fight.
Now, part of the people that you were part of for that preparation has been getting in the ring with Adrian Broner. Now, as I understand, you guys have a history with each other. You guys have known each other a long time. Can you talk about the work you've been getting with him and just that history?
Yeah. Really, he has nothing to do with, you know, me, like, what, in preparation for me fighting Matisse. But, you know, he comes to my gym a lot. And it's always nice to get some good rounds in there with him because, of course, you know he's really fast. And he's a top-level fighter. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I can be sparring guys that, you know, we would consider sparring partners. But to me, I'm always about challenging myself and sparring the best guys. So, you know, even the guys in my gym, you know, I spar with my brother a lot. I spar with middleweights that you'll see coming up in the next few months and years. And, you know, really guys that can fight. And that's the way I like my sparring. And he likes the same thing. So, you know, me and him, we can easily get in the round and do 40 minutes straight, 45 minutes straight, and not even take a break and not even think about it. You know, we're going to talk trash while we're doing it, but it's all love out of it.
What do you – because, you know, your career, you look at your career and you're fighting – there's that saying, in order to be the best, you have to fight the best. And obviously, you're one of those guys that are always willing to put their record on the line. You put your skills to the test. Where do you put Lucas Matisse at in terms of level of competition? Because you have faced some of the highest levels out there so far.
I think he's right up there with any other top guys that I've fought. You know, like you said before, you know, I'm one who loves to test myself. You know, as you can see on my resume, there's no washed up fighters, no, you know, over the hill fighters, no older fighters. You know, when I went for the title, I went for the title with a guy that was my age, in his prime, who was probably at the time a few steps ahead of me. But, you know, it was no problem with me. I was the number one contender. I wanted to fight for the title, so that's what I did. And after that, you know, it was, you know, next fight after next fight. You know, I don't really see the reason of taking easy fights. But Matisse, I think, is right there with you know, with the Victor Ortiz and the Americans and everybody else that I've fought in the last 3-4 years. And I just think, you know, he's a solid guy all over, you know, all around. You know, he's not one who's going to give up. You know, as far as, you know, when you look at tape, you look for weaknesses, like, you know, people, do they give up? You know, they weak points and they strong points. I don't really see too many weak points in them, really. It's just, you know, about me going out, executing my game plan, and it's giving 100%, you know, the best of my piece that I can give. And I think if I do that, you know, I shouldn't have any problem with getting
it. You know, fight fans have really taken and fallen in love with Lucas Matisse's power. And what preparations do you have to work on and seeing, because obviously knocking out a Mike Dallas, I don't know if you were impressed by that. You know, fight fans were just really overly impressed of that knockout he did over Mike Dallas. But what mind frame, what thoughts are going through your mind when you see something like that in terms of being prepared for a guy that does have heavy hands?
At the end of the day, you know, I believe in my defense. I believe in, you know, my ability to take a punch and my will to win. So, like I said before, this is what we signed up for. I know I'm going to get punched in the face, and I'm going to get some punching. So, I'm not worried about taking a punch. You know, that's just not a big problem with me.
Because I got to tell you, you know, from the Lamont of a couple years ago was a cutie boxer. I don't know what happened to him. You know, it was like a change of it's almost like your brother's spirit kind of jumped into you, or if it was there all along, it was a sleeping giant. It's been awoken, and we see a completely different fighter here. You know,
my trainer always taught me fight many different ways. So at the end of the day, I'm going, you know, when we sit down and we come up with a game plan, we go with the best way to win for that night. And just recently, you know, a lot of the fights we've been, you know, talking, and we'll say, okay, we're going to go at this guy. But, you know, sometimes the game plan might not be to go at the guy. If it's boxing, then that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go out and show you the boxer that I always been. Being the slugger at this point, it's because I thought I was stronger than the person. I knew that I probably was in better shape than the person that I was fighting, and I knew eventually I could wear them down. And, you know, I just know that a lot of fighters don't work on inside fighting. So I seem to try to expose them in that area. And so that's just been the game plan lately, but, you know, I still can box. And I think a lot of people forget that. But, you know, I just do whatever it takes to win.
Talking again about Broner, he's moving up to 147. He's leapfrogging a whole division to get there, to fight Pauly Malignaggi. I think it's just a simple case of good matchmaking. But can you assess how you feel he's going to do north of 135 pounds?
I think in this fight in particular with Malignaggi, he'll do great. You know, he's moving up to welterweight, jumping over 140 pounds, jumping two weight classes. But you got to understand where Pauly, you know, what weight class Pauly came from. You know, he's not the biggest puncher. He's not that strong. He's not the biggest guy, at welterweight. And once you see them side by side, you'll see that they're probably the same size. So I don't think he'll have no problem. You know, Broner is a tremendous talent, so he can do things like that. You know, he's young, you know, and he's focused right now. So at the end of the day, if he put his mind to it, I think he'll do great.
Let me ask you about that, because obviously he's you know, trending in the waters you're at in that division. You know, the rumor is that Floyd packed up your bags and sent you out of his camp because of the work you put against him. Are you doing similar things to Broner to kind of remind him, like, hey, buddy, this is my division. I know you're coming up to face Pauly Malignaggi, and we all know why, but don't get too comfortable in this division, because there might be a chance you guys may be facing each other down the line.
Well, in that case, you know, even, you know, with me sparring Zab Judah and all other guys I spar, it's sparring. I know it's a big difference between fighting and sparring. And so I try not to get caught into I have anything to prove to anybody at this point. You know, I've been in this game for 18 years, and I've realized that sparring is just sparring. And like I said, 18 years in this game, I really have nothing to prove to anyone. You know, at the end of the day, a contract is signed to fight a guy, then that's when my focus is on fighting the guy. But at this point, you know,
Lamont, you're telling me that no pride kicks in, and when a guy punches you in the face, and you know they're not, you know, you're supposed to go 60 in sparring, but when a guy gives you an extra 100%, you don't return the favor to them?
If I feel the need to, of course. If I know he's doing it and he's trying to challenge me, of course, that the competitive nature is just going to kick in. But at this point, you know, I really haven't had any problems with anyone.
Is that what happened with you and Floyd? Did he decide to go 100, not 60, so you had to put it on?
At the end of the day, with the Floyd thing, I just chalked it up as it was good fun.
Man, Andre taught you well, man.
It wasn't about, you know, him challenging me or me challenging him. It was just,
right,
you know, we were working pretty good. People got into it, and that was that.
You can't be from D.C. and not be a good politician. You were very deft here. Looking around, though, you know what I'm curious about the Broner thing. I don't mean to harp on it, but when you get work like that, you have an insight that nobody else does. How does he match up with everybody around? I know Pauly's a good matchup for him, for obvious reasons. I mean, he's speedy, he can box, but you know, you're not worried about the incoming. But against a Matisse or a guy like yourself, do you think physically he's going to be able to compete? Is he really a welterweight, and he's just kind of growing into that?
As far as being a welterweight, I can't really say at this point, but I can tell you this: he's definitely, you know, he can fight, compete at lightweight. You know that,
right?
But to me, to be honest, I'll put him at junior welterweight right now. You know, he's little, but he fights, you know, kind of big. So Jimmy Welterweight, I'll put him there, and I think he will compete with anybody in the division.
For you, what is this fight? You know, each fight has kind of meant something. You know, the Khan fight was about, then I could be wrong, but how I looked at it was like showing that, you know what, I can break through. I do belong at the elite level. This last fight was about proving that you're back. What does the Matisse fight prove to you? Is it do you look at each fight like that as a specific test?
I think so. Every fight is, you know, kind of different. I think I'm still trying to. For me, you know, a lot of people gonna say this and probably say that about, you know, what I can do and what I can't do. So I know it's a lot to me. You know, a lot of times when you see a fight, that's what you see pretty much every fight. For me, you know, like I said before, I have a lot of different styles, different ways that I can win fights. So I think, you know, each time I go out, different style of fighter that I'm going to fight, and I have to bring a different to the ring, that they kind of add on to what I already know how to do. And you can really see the complete, at the end of my career, you can see a complete Lamont. And look at, if you go back to all my fights and see that, you know, how, you know, I adapt to different styles and I do the same thing every fight. I think that's important. So, you know, in this fight, I'll try to show a little bit more of what I can do, not the same old Lamont. But, and another thing is, you know, with this drug testing thing, I mean, with this failed drug test with the milk, MidCon and all that, just still letting people know and reminding them that I don't need any, you know, testosterone, steroids, anything like that to compete on the top level. You know, I showed that with Kendall Hall, and I'll continue to show it with Lucas Matisse.
Are you guys doing testing for the fight?
Yeah, I did. I filled out the papers, and, you know, with, I think it was, I think it was WADA. USADA, I think. One of them, and I think we're gonna do random drug testing, but I haven't heard anything back after I filled all my papers out and sent everything in. And whenever they come, you know, they're welcome to come to the gym, to my home, or wherever the case may be, to do the drug testing. And just hope that, you know, everything's clean and we can get a fans to fight that they want to see.
This fight's also being fought at the catch weight, 141. There's no titles at stake, but it is indeed a 12-round fight, yeah?
Can you say it again?
It's definitely a 12-round fight, though, right? Even though it's the fight at the catch weight and everything with no
uh-huh.
titles. Okay, I was just double-checking on that. One of the
why
fans was asking.
Why is it a catch weight?
Yeah.
As far as I knew, I thought, you know, that I was fighting for, you know, putting my title on the line. And news got back to me that it was, you know, not going to be on the line. I really still don't understand the situation and don't have a full understanding of the situation. I do have some understanding of it. But as I was told, you know, they wanted him to put up his WBC interim title, and I don't, as I recall, that I don't think that he wanted to put it up. So it's like kind of back and forth with that, and then eventually, you know, the agreement was to just fight. You know, at the end of the day, that's, you know, that's the fight that me and him wanted. So it was like, you know, why put, you know, let this other stuff get in between, you know, us fighting, and we just decided to go on with the fight.
So this wasn't between two fighters. This was what, management or promoters not wanting to put titles on the line? I'm not really understanding that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. I know it had nothing to do with me. And, you know, with me, it makes no difference. I believe that, you know, we're two of the top guys that's fighting right now, and the belt should be on the line. But sometimes, you know, with your managers, promoters, and things like that, you just, the agreement sometimes, they just can't agree on things, and things like this happen. And like I said, you know, boxing, this is boxing. Things that never to surprise me. But I think the main thing right now is that we're still fighting. And I think that's the important part right now.
Man, that's the warrior mentality of Lamont Peterson right there. Hey, brother, thank you again for coming on, leaving the ring. I want to thank Andre for always, you know, coming through. can't wait for this fight. This is a really exciting fight. Glad to see you get back in the ring and do your thing and continue to do what you do best, that the fight fans are just rooting for you and behind you all the way. And even the haters that, you know, they don't want to believe the truth, it's all right because you still know they're going to tune in to watch the fight.
Right. All right, thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah.
You know, anytime, interview, just let Dre know, and I'm all for it.
I really appreciate it. And, yeah,
Dave,
good luck in your,
Dave,
good luck in your training.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, right, thank
man.
You.
Thank you.
All right, guys.
Thank
our
you,
pleasure.
Guys. Sorry.
All right.
All right, all right
take care.
Lamont Peterson here on Leaving the Ring Radio, talking about Lucas Matisse's Adrian Broner. And,
sorry, sent you a text and threw you off.
Yeah, let me.
We'll be calling him in shortly.
We'll be calling him in.
I said as soon as we're done with the Peterson interview because we were scheduled at 6:30. So.
Oh, my bad.
Everything got pushed back just a little bit because the George Foreman interview. But everybody's rolling with us. Up next is writer Bryn Jonathan Butler. He's also a filmmaker, director, who's doing a documentary about Guillermo Rigondeaux. It has been for a number of years. I believe it's called Split Decisions. So I think Dave's calling him in right now, and we will grab him.
Bryn Jonathan
Butler,
right?
Actually, I think he's on the line. He's in the queue.
You won't be able to get through, remember?
Oh.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. Is this Bryn Jonathan?
Yeah, speaking. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. This is Dave Duenas with my co-host Gabriel Montoya here on Leaving the Ring Radio.
Cool.
Sorry about that. We kind of had an issue with Blog Talk, so we had to call you in and deviate from the plan. It's kind of thrown us back about 10 minutes. But let's get right into it, man. You are a guy that has really been on top of what's going on with Cuban boxing, but more importantly, what's been going on with Guillermo Rigondeaux and been kind of chronicling his career through your documentary and writings. I wanted to introduce you to our fans and just have you kind of educate us both on the history of Cuban boxing, what's going on there, how it's changed, but also his journey, which I think is a very special one, and we got to see it Saturday night. So I guess first, just kind of explain what it is you do and what brought you to the story of Guillermo Rigondeaux.
Well, I've been working on a documentary, kind of exploring, I guess, sort of the health of Cuban society on the whole through the lens of Cuban boxers from, I guess, starting with Teofilo Stevenson, a fighter in the 1970s who was offered about $5 million to leave the island to fight Muhammad Ali. He turned that down, and from there I kind of tracked every significant Cuban fighter that I could speak with, from Felix Sabon, who was offered in the neighborhood of $20 million to leave to fight Mike Tyson, Hector Venant, who was a two-time Olympian with quite a similar story to Guillermo in terms of he was thrown off the team for fear that he intended to defect, even though he never actually tried, and in fact actually didn't want to leave, to Guillermo's story, whom I met in 2007 in Havana. I've been training there since 2000 with Hector Venant, and after Guillermo was thrown off the team in the summer of 2007, I was there in November, and Guillermo just happened to stop by the gym that I was training at, and that's where that story sort of got a hold of me, was exploring the fact that the Cuban government had thrown him off the team for attempting to defect in Brazil, and yet the vast majority of Cubans that I knew and spoke with were very sympathetic to his reasons for leaving. And in my documentary, it kind of goes ahead to look at some of the youth and some of the younger national champions to explore some of their reasons for staying or leaving and how Guillermo's journey has impacted Cuban society for both boxers as well as ordinary citizens that, you know, obviously with his success, he's now made over $1 million as a professional, that I think, you know, even though I think it was kind of a fluke that he had the opportunity to get that fight, that the American dream is still there if you're willing to work for it. So,
how do you mean
it was a long-winded way?
No, no, it's great. How do you mean it was a fluke and just that because of the Cold War between Top Rank and Golden Boy, the fight that everybody wanted, which was the Morris fight, and probably would have favored Donaire in terms of style, was unavailable, and so Rigondeaux was kind of the last resort?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one peg of why it would have been very difficult for it to come to fruition. Just him making it to the United States after the failed defection was incredibly difficult and dangerous. His career coming up outside of the ring was very tumultuous with numerous lawsuits against his manager. Seems that the more lucrative the fight, the more drama there is associated with it. Apart from the Golden Boy Top Rank feud, I mean, he just has a lot of issues acclimating to life in the U.S. I mean, this is a guy in Cuba who had every decision made for him, and you know, he's never had a bank account in his life until he came to the U.S. at the age of, you know, almost 30 years old. So there's a lot that Cubans contend with outside of the ring, whereas inside of the ring, of course, I think Guillermo demonstrated they're some of the most capable fighters that have ever lived. And certainly his success against Donaire, who was heavily favored, I think validates the cases of those matchups I mentioned before with Stevenson and Sabone. They might have done a lot better than most writers had given them a chance to have done.
Recently they were talking, I'd read that Cuba was talking about going professional, allowing these guys to compete professionally, particularly with the advent of the World Series of Boxing and AIBA basically becoming a promoter. Is that coming to fruition? Do you think that with the kind of newer regime that things are going to change and that we'll see it, or is the onus on America to lift its sanctions on Cuba and actually allow them to come into the 20th century on some level?
Yeah, I think it's on both sides. I think one of the things that's really ugly and I think predominantly I focused on with the documentary is that the real villain of the story is not you know, the kind of traps that await unsuspecting Cubans in the United States in the world of boxing or fighting for a dictator like Fidel, but it's the choice itself of what they have to endure just before they can even get to American soil. It's just so dangerous. I mean, they estimate that 30% of Cubans who've tried to leave to get to the United States have died making the journey. And, yeah,
well,
I think there will be changes in Cuba. There are changes, but
how many of them are boxers?
Predominantly, Cuban athletes have never left. You've never had the great fighters or the great ball players leave in their prime to come to the United States. Even though we always look at all the reasons for them leaving, the vast majority have stayed, and the vast majority that I interviewed were, for the most part, quite content with that decision, and seemed a lot more, I guess, content with their reasons for fighting, and I don't know, just as human beings, they seemed a lot more content than their American counterparts that I interviewed. And I think Gabrielle was saying that you had George Foreman on the air.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he was somebody I interviewed who I thought it amazed me, but he described Teofilo Stevenson as the greatest fighter of the 1970s, the most dominant fighter as an amateur or a pro. And, Felix Sabone seemed like a much more content person than Mike Tyson when I interviewed him. So it's a very strange society that I think a lot of people outside of that country don't really want to accept. And yet at the same time, of course, they are living in poverty. I mean, even these great champions who are living better than most are living, you know, in a suburban two-bedroom house with no gasoline for their car in some cases, or no tires for their car like Teofilo Stevenson was. So it's a really crazy situation.
It also kind of seems that even when they defect over here, that the community the Cuban community doesn't really embrace them. I mean, why do you think that?
Well, I know I asked that question quite a lot with Bob Arum and some of the other promoters. I spoke to that issue with Don King as well, who made that offer, and so did Arum to Stevenson and Savone. Arum's response was that it was a racial issue, that almost all the boxers are black. I don't think that's necessarily fair, and I just
what does he mean black? It mean black skinned Latinos? Is that what he's referring to, or what? Or there's just
yeah,
black
that was,
athletes?
No, that was his implication, is that Miami is about 95% non-black Cuban of the Cuban American society there, versus almost every athlete that's come over, well, specific to boxing, has been black or much darker skinned. And, you know, that is a kind of weird dynamic, is that the people who are facilitating a lot of this human trafficking, and let's not forget that a lot of these athletes, I mean, who are leaving, are having people sent over there from Florida or from Europe, and are being lured with contracts where they could sign away 4 or 5 years of their career for $50-$60 down. That moves it from human trafficking, to my mind, to something more like a modern slave trade, where, you know, were they not in an impoverished nation under duress, signing contracts in many cases that they can't even understand the language that it's being signed in, they're grossly being taken advantage of. And I think it's one reason that when they come over to the United States or fight internationally, many Cubans have fought in Ireland, for example, and Germany, they certainly aren't impassioned in the way that you see Puerto Rican fighters or Mexican fighters or other Latino fighters, because I think they do have a larger grievance in just what it took them to get into that ring. They're beholden to people that they would not otherwise sign with in many cases.
So the passion comes from, or the lack of passion comes from the fact that, well, even if I win, I'm probably giving a bunch of money to this guy and that guy and the pirates that brought me over here. I'm probably going to end up with maybe a quarter of my purse. So, you know, and then they're going to keep me fighting because I'm kind of a slave anyways. So what does it really matter? It's not a guy fighting to improve his position. He's working out a slave contract, literally a slave contract.
Well, I think if you look at Yoel Casamayor, who's easily, at least in terms of how he's financially been compensated for his professional career, I think estimates are that he's made between $10 and $12 million, or he made between $10 or $12 million, that he's now broke. And from what I was told when he was working Redondo's Corner, he was paid a flat fee of $1,500 for the privilege. So, I mean, imagine how Redondo would look at somebody like him who, you know, Casamayor left just before the 96 games and was a world champion, I think was a world champion in three weight classes or a three-time world champion. Whatever his situation was, it sure managed to dilute whatever money he earned in rapid succession.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think without question, he's probably the most successful Cuban fighter ever, right, that's come over in terms of his accomplishments and everything. That's depressing. I mean, I guess he just becomes like any other fighter, but you would say that you know, most people kind of attract parasites as they get success, but the Cuban fighters, when they get here, they come kind of already prepackaged with a few parasites already attached.
Well, that's just the nature of the journey. It's just intrinsic to that Cuban experience that, you know, an American can't bring over a Cuban. It's a felony by U.S. law for human trafficking, so they have to find third parties to do it. Almost all the Cubans have seemed to go to the exact same place in terms of the promotional side and management. I don't think that's by accident. I certainly don't think it's by virtue of the wonderful record of Cuban fighters who've come. I mean, if George Luis Gonzalez is any example of a dominant amateur fighter who just did nothing, was just a complete embarrassment in the pro ranks. You know, and there are many, many examples of that. And I mean, even if you look at baseball with the most famous cases of El Duque or Livon Hernandez going on to win, World Series and World Series MVPs, that the agent who was known to go over to sign them and bring them over was taking 25% of their contracts. When the average baseball agent is making between 2 and 5%. So this is just, it's fascinating to me that the Cuban community who wants them to come over to sort of thumb their nose at Fidel Castro are, in many cases, the first ones to just take advantage of them once they get there, despite how vulnerable they are, given that they have no education about how to run their own career. And, I mean, this is, Larry Merchant said to me in my documentary that you won't find a more raw, distilled form of capitalism than professional boxing. So, again, these people are just so singularly ill-equipped to deal with everything outside that ring.
What makes Rico special to you? I mean, we know that we can break it down in terms of numbers, but for you, what about him? I mean, was he just, like you said, he represents that choice? It was just kind of that choice personified. Do you stay there and remain a god, but and that's kind of a relative term, or do you come here and go for the glory? For you, what is it about him?
Oh, well, for me, why I love boxing is it's such a perfect distillation of just narrative. You know, what are we fighting for? It's such a way to reduce anybody to what you stand for, what you stand against. And I think that's what makes boxing magical, is for some reason how it just reduces you to your essence. And in Rigondo's case, I think he has one of the most powerful narratives of any fighter since, I don't know, maybe Joe Louis, you know, fighting on behalf of the United States against the Nazis and for his own race in American society. Rigondo was Castro's pawn against the United States. He was not defeating Americans in the ring. He was taking on America and the American system itself. But the one magical thing about a pawn on a chessboard is it's the only piece that can transform. And in this case, he had to travel, those 90 miles, one of the biggest graveyards on earth of his own people, in order to make a statement, which he did against Donaire. You know, that was him making $1 million in America. That was him beating, the 2012 ESPN Fighter of the Year, proving that he could, he could compete at that level. And, one of the things his manager said that fascinated me, and I fully agree with it, was that Guillermo could have fought Donaire and put on the same performance in his first fight. Everything that he brought into the ring against Donaire, he brought with him from Cuba. We saw Guillermo at almost 33 years old. Guillermo was an Olympic champion back in 2000. So he's just, apart from being one of the most exceptional packages I've ever seen on film, or certainly live as a fighter, I think his backstory is just fascinating. When he tried to leave, his father disowned him for disloyalty to Fidel Castro. His mother was supportive, but she died shortly after, right around the time that leading up to his fight against Cordoba. He left behind two kids and a wife who he was with for 13 years in Havana. You look at the stakes involved in him making it in the United States. It was just the biggest high wire act in sports. I just found all that extraordinary, and of course, the big difficulty in making a film about him is he's very reticent to discuss the most compelling aspects of his narrative. So it just made it a big mystery for me to find out. I don't know that I'd ever get my hands on the truth of it, but I definitely got my hands on a lot of different versions of it from people intimately acquainted with his story and involved with it.
When he left, was there repercussions to his family? I mean, having a two-bedroom house, was that taken away from them? Did his family get shunned from his father as well by leaving, coming here to the States?
Well, their house is definitely one of the most politically radioactive in the country, and it's under 24-hour surveillance by two cameras. I was able to track down their house just because people on the street knew exactly where it was across Havana. But I was warned, if you go, you probably are never going to come back to this country again. And certainly, you know, I don't know when the police really picked up on my tail, but going to Teofilo Stevenson's house and getting the last interview he ever granted before his death or Rigondo's family, definitely it changed the dynamic dramatically of trying to illegally obtain interviews with these guys. And yeah, they were definitely under some duress. They said they were not punished.
So, but, in their eyes, you were doing something that was, that was being a criminal. I mean, is that how they were looking at what you were doing by documenting the journey of one fighter?
Well, I was looking at, I think, more than the journey of one fighter. I